Murder, She Spoke is a true crime podcast hosted by me, Joanna Shanks.
And me, Emma Taylor. Each week we bring you a new case with a particular focus on crimes committed in Scotland, chosen by us or suggested by our listeners. The cases we cover typically involve violent assaults and murder, and listener discretion is advised.
We discuss each case in detail, looking at the psychological and legal elements, and end each episode on a light note. Listen to us today on your podcast platform of choice, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. What is important to your life story? If a spotlight were to shine on your life, what would you like to be in focus? Would it be your friends and family, your faith, your children, partner? Answering that question honestly for yourself will assist you in determining the crux of who you are. It's your foundation. But what if I was to take that focus, the one you worked so hard to figure out using the questions I just asked? What if the important becomes the trivial, and the most mundane becomes central? There comes a time in each person's life where they consider what is important, what is truly important. We all have our own things. Now, whether that's relationships, faith, or career, it doesn't matter. You can choose any or all of those items. But what happens if the item you did not choose becomes one of the central points of an argument against you? The reality is, you don't really care about that portion of your identity. There isn't a personal buy-in. To the other person, it's what they are going to attack. It's going to be the focus. Bring in that magnifying glass again. Media has a habit of offering information without context. Let's add a little context surrounding the trial of Eileen Warnos. In 1992, there was a presidential election going on between Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and Ross Perot. While Bill Clinton won the presidential election with 43% of the vote, religion played a huge part throughout, particularly for the conservative right. In his writing, Religion and the U.S. Presidential Election of 1992, James E. Wood, Jr. wrote, quote, "Religion has long played a prominent role in American politics. It has played a major role in more than one-third of the U.S. presidential elections. Not since the 1984 campaign of President Ronald Reagan for a second term, however, has religion figured so prominently in an American presidential election year. The presidential election of 1992 has seen exacerbation of this trend, especially in the mobilization of the religious right in support of right-wing politics, the Republican Party." End quote. I think it's safe to say that politics in our country tend to represent some of the values, morals, and beliefs that we have as a nation. While George H.W. Bush did not win that election in 1992, he received a large amount of the vote. While the religious right does not represent all Americans' beliefs, in Florida, it played a large role. In short, there was a large conservative population in the U.S., as there is today. Not only conservative, but also religious. This in and of itself is not a problem, and would not be a problem, unless it seeps its way into what should be a non-prejudicial, unbiased trial. It did, it had, and it still does today. Throughout my coverage of this case, there is a balancing act I have been performing, whether or not one believes Eileen, whether or not one believes in her profession of sex worker, her profession took a major part in this trial. If she was a professor, a mechanic, or anything else, would it have played a large part in the trial? If sex work was not such a cornerstone of the prosecution's attack while she and others were on the stand, how would that have altered the end result? Or would it have? These questions did not end with Eileen Warnos. In the early 2000s, Michael Peterson was charged, arrested, and found guilty of first-degree murder in a Durham, North Carolina courtroom. What was determined to be key evidence in the trial involved his bisexual sexuality as well as his more intimate discussions with male escorts. The prosecution leaned into this hard in order to prove that his relationship with Kathleen, his wife who died, wasn't as idyllic as they made it out to be. But that's not necessarily a clear depiction of a bad marriage or an unhappy relationship. In the trial, it was just unheard of that someone would know their husband was bisexual and would accept it. Would the moral outrage have been the same if he was going to strip clubs? Would it be different or utilized as strongly to villainize? Moral, virtue, religion-based outrage has no place in law or the justice system. The facts, science, experts, all have a part. Bringing in this type of outrage is pandering to the jury and greater public. A person's life is not boiled down to one piece of their identity. You'll see today that Eileen Warnos' life was boiled down to sex work, with the subtext of the closing arguments being that being a sex worker meant Eileen was asking for it. Let's get into it. First, we will hear the closing arguments by the defense.
Members of the jury, you are here today, having heard and considered over 2 weeks of testimony in this case. Your job is now about to begin. You are to discover the truth, and by the truth, we mean what happened on December 1st, 1989. You are not to determine what happened in June of 1990, July of 1990, or in November of 1990. You are to decide but one issue in this case, where there is only one issue before you. That is whether Eileen Warnos felt that she had to take Richard Mallory's life on December 1st, 1989. I remind you of this, people, because in this case, unlike any other, so much of what you've heard has nothing to do with December of 1989. So much of what you have heard has nothing to do with what Eileen Warnos was thinking when she pulled the trigger in December of 1989. In order to do your jobs properly, you have to remind yourself that there will be other juries and other judges who will make determinations as to what happened 6 months to 1 year after Richard Mallory was killed. You must consider Richard Mallory and nothing else. And you must consider that tragic evening when Eileen Warnos felt compelled to take Mr. Mallory's life in a dark, secluded area in the early morning hours. As you consider the facts and evidence that came from that stand, as it applied to Richard Mallory, and as it applied to what happened in December of 1989, three simple truths will emerge. Eileen Warnos is not guilty of premeditated first-degree murder. She is not guilty of felony murder. She is not guilty of robbery. Consider the witnesses that the state presented to you. You did hear a lot of testimony. Early on, we heard some testimony that Richard Mallory was found in an isolated area and that several items were found near his car. Remember that Eileen Warnos told you those things as well. None of that is in dispute. You heard that among those items were half-empty vodka bottles, two glass tumblers that were put in a little area near the car. Eileen Warnos told you how they got there. She told you how the bottle got half empty. You later learned that Smirnoff was Mr. Mallory's brand and that he had a drinking problem. And Miss Warnos told you that as well. You learned that Richard Mallory's pants were on when he was found, but that his belt is adjusted to one side, approximately 4 to 6 inches, and then he had nothing on underneath his pants. And you will recall Eileen told you how that happened as well. Later in the first week, you were told how Mr. Mallory died. You were told that he was shot, and you heard this originally from Dr. Bodding. And you may recall Dr. Bodding is kind of a heavy-set, white-haired gentleman that testified the first week. Dr. Bodding performed what he termed an autopsy on Mr. Mallory, but you might recall that Dr. Bodding didn't draw a diagram to show you where Mr. Mallory was injured. He didn't estimate the size of Mr. Mallory, and he didn't do any tests to determine whether or not Mr. Mallory had sexual activity before he was killed. I call your attention to those things because you will recall what you heard from other medical examiners, other experts who told you that those kind of things were standard procedures for a medical examiner. And you should also recall, and perhaps more importantly recall, what Dr. Bodding did not tell you. He could not tell you how far away Richard Mallory was when he was shot. He could not tell you the sequence of the shots. He could not tell you, most importantly, what was happening before Richard Mallory was shot. Simply put, Dr. Bodding couldn't tell you anything about self-defense. He could tell you nothing. So what other evidence did you get? Well, you learned how Mr. Mallory's car was found in an isolated area. Again, Lee Warnos told you where this car was left. You learned that a search of local nude bars and strip joints were conducted to find Mr. Mallory. You also learned that a stripper named Chastity Marcus had been with Mr. Mallory shortly before his death, and then she was at one point arrested. You learned that Mr. Mallory was known to smoke pot, just as Lee Warnos told you he had been doing. You were also given some technical advice. You were shown bullets. You were shown this gun. You were shown this guy. And you will also recall that Lee Warnos not only told you that this was indeed her gun, and that yes, she had shot Richard Mallory with it, but she even told police where to find it. As the trial moved on, you heard a great deal of testimony, and this is particularly true of last week about incidents that began 6 months after Richard Mallory was killed. You also heard the testimony of a certain Bobby Lee Copas. He was the rather heavy-set truck driver that came in, and he claimed to have met Lee Warnos nearly a year after Mr. Mallory had been killed. When considering Bobby Lee Copas, first ask yourselves whether Lee Warnos' behavior in 1990 had anything to do with what was going through her mind in December of 1989. Then ask yourselves, is Bobby Lee Copas telling you the truth? Bobby Lee Copas, who testified that he saw a gun in Miss Warnos' purse, and it was a small caliber firearm, and he knew it was a small caliber firearm because it was a tiny little gun, like the one his wife carried. I ask you to handle this weapon. Look at it carefully, and you determine, is Bobby Lee Copas telling you the truth? A man who remembers verbatim what a complete stranger told him a year before, but forgot to tell the police about it? Lee Warnos is telling you the truth when she said she had never even seen Mr. Copas. So after 2 weeks of testimony, 2 weeks of evidence, the state asked you to determine the issue in this case. Did Lee Warnos act in self-defense? Well, they leave you with essentially two witnesses to decide this issue. Those two witnesses are Tyra Moore and Detective Horzepa. First, you will remember Tyra Moore, Lee's former lover who testified the first week. Rather heavy-set woman, rather short hair, stoic. And what the state wanted you to hear from Tyra Moore was that Lee Warnos had come to her in December of 1989 and told her she'd killed a man. She said it over and over again. But what else did Tyra Moore tell you? And what were her motivations for doing so? First of all, you'll recall that Tyra Moore was a suspect. She had wrecked a car and been seen in that car, and as a result, a picture of her was shown on TV. You must remember that Tyra Moore had known for over a year that Lee Warnos had shot Richard Mallory. And she didn't leave. And she didn't call the police. And you have to ask yourselves, what does that tell you? Either Lee was telling the truth, or Tyra Moore really did know it was self-defense. Tyra Moore did start to care, only when she thought that this might affect her, and not just Lee Warnos. When she saw that she might catch some heat, she left. She went half a country away, leaving Lee Warnos behind. Eventually, Tyra Moore was found in the state of Pennsylvania, and eventually law enforcement officers talked to her about this case, and they asked her if she'd do them a little favor. She was brought down to the state of Florida. She was put up in a motel room with money from our government. Her meals were paid for. Her cigarettes were paid for. Her room was paid for. And all she had to do was write Lee a note. Write Lee a little note. Have Lee call her. Also, Tyra Moore could implicate Lee Warnos. And so, Tyra pulled Lee's emotional strings during 11 phone calls in January 1991. And Lee Warnos will do what Tyra Moore wants because Lee Warnos loves Tyra Moore. Lee Warnos will do anything for Tyra Moore. Lee Warnos would die for Tyra Moore. And Tyra, of course, knew this, and she knew it well because Lee had opened herself up to Tyra and told her this on numerous occasions. So, in January of 1991, Tyra Moore lied to her lover, and she cried to her lover, and she ultimately threatened suicide to her lover. Until Lee Warnos was terrified that Ty would be arrested, or worse, and gave Larry Horzepa, Bruce Munster, and Ty Moore exactly what they wanted. And Ty went back up north. It wasn't long after Ty went up north that she got a friendly little phone call from Bruce Munster from the Marion County Sheriff's Office. She was told at that time, well, if she wanted to, she could share his lawyer and she could make a little money off this thing. How much money? You heard it was $50,000. And while it is true that Tyra told you she hasn't gotten any money for her story yet, certainly she was considering it. She was considering it when she called her law enforcement friend Rose Giansanti on the phone and talked to her about it and asked her what she was dealing with. And consider that relationship, the relationship between Rose Giansanti and Tyra Moore. Rose Giansanti, who was assigned to watch over a potential murder suspect for 4 days and gave her anything she wanted, paid for it with government money, and who's been in contact with this woman long after her job has required her to. You will recall Rose Giansanti goes out to dinner with Ty, and she chauffeured her from the airport, and she brought her here to this courtroom, and tried to sit in the courtroom as Ty testified. Nonetheless, Tyra Moore was a witness with obvious reasons to try to please law enforcement in this state with her testimony. She did offer some valuable insights into this case. First off, you will recall Ty told you that in 4.5 years of living every day with Eileen Warnos, not once did Eileen raise a hand at her. She said they argued. More importantly, she told you Lee didn't strike anyone else. And you'll recall the state attorney asking, well, wasn't there a bar fight or something? No. And what did she tell you about Lee's drinking? Yes, Lee drank a lot. And she did drink to become more outgoing, and in fact, that is what happened when she drank. She did become more outgoing, as Tyra Moore testified, as did Lee Warnos. Another thing that Tyra Moore told you, she kind of told you in a backwards way. You recall the state was asking Tyra Moore some questions about when Lee came home in December of 1989 with Richard Mallory's Cadillac, asking, was her speech all slurred? Was she stumbling around? No? No. But on cross-examination, one simple question. Was she intoxicated? Was she drunk? Yes. Again, Lee Warnos said yes as well. And it wasn't long after Lee brought that Cadillac home that Lee tried to tell Ty about what had happened, and how she had ended up with that car, and when Lee Warnos went to Tyra Moore and told Tyra, I really need to tell you something. When Lee Warnos confided in her only real friend in the world, and she needed to talk to her, she needed to tell her something. Something horrible had happened, Tyra's response was very simple. I don't want to hear about it. Just as Ty didn't want to hear about Lee's job, because, as you'll recall, Ty said she was jealous when Lee went out with other men. You'll also recall that Tyra wasn't so jealous that she wasn't willing to spend Lee's money. She just didn't want to hear where Lee got it. She didn't want to hear how Lee suffered to get it. She didn't want to hear how Lee was raped and beaten numerous times. Tyra Moore didn't want to hear it. And the words, "I don't want to hear it," should remind you of the other key state witness in this case, Detective Larry Horzepa. You will recall Mr. Horzepa took that witness stand on 3 separate occasions, and it was he who, with Detective Munster, talked to Lee for 3 hours a year ago. And it was that tape that you saw in this courtroom. Well, now you have the task of deciding Mr. Horzepa's credibility as a witness, and in doing so, consider this simple question. Why did Larry Horzepa have to take that witness stand and tell you what Lee Warnos told him when you could see it for yourself? The answer to that question is simple. Larry Horzepa put together what he called a synopsis of what happened to Mr. Mallory, and what Lee had told him about in January of 1991. And when he did this, he was very, very careful to extract anything which lets you know, number one, why Lee was talking to him in the first place, and number two, and far more importantly, why Lee shot Richard Mallory. Larry Horzepa did not want to know the answer to the only question which is important in this case, and that is, why did Lee Warnos feel that she had to shoot Mr. Mallory? And it's just as obvious. It should be just as obvious why Larry Horzepa did not want you to know the answer to that question. The answer is simple. Because in spite of what he tried to tell you, the tape speaks for itself, and Lee Warnos said it over and over and over again in January of 1991 and again in January of 1992. That she defended herself in December of 1989, but Larry Horzepa, just like Ty, didn't want to hear about it. Fortunately, in the cross-examination that you heard in this case, Mr. Horzepa was exposed. Consider, if you will, his original testimony. You will recall that Mr. Horzepa had some notes right here on this stand, and you will recall that Mr. Nolas came and got those notes, and he looked at them when he had a few minutes over at the table. And when he was questioned again about those notes, you will recall that there was a reference in the typewritten notes, which he had prepared to help himself testify. And in the notes, there was a reference where Lee Warnos had said that this man was hurting her, and Larry Horzepa wrote, in his own handwriting, off to the side, 2 words, which explained Larry Horzepa to each and every one of you. Those 2 words were, "Don't use." Don't use, people, means don't let the jury hear. Don't let you hear. You! You are who to decide what really happened in this case. According to Mr. Horzepa, you are to hear that Lee Warnos wanted to talk. She wanted to talk to investigators about Richard Mallory's death, but you're not to hear why. You aren't to hear that Lee Warnos occasionally got confused in those 3 hours of statements, but you're not to hear why. You are to hear that Richard Mallory was shot by Lee Warnos, but you are not to hear why. The why is the only issue in this case. You will remember Mr. Nolas asked Mr. Horzepa, why did you or Mr. Munster never ask why Lee felt her life was in danger? Why didn't you ever ask what Mr. Mallory was doing to her? And Mr. Horzepa's response was, well, I wanted to let her talk. I didn't want to interrupt her. I didn't want to put words in her mouth. You will remember these statements from the tape. At one point, Lee Warnos saying, he's hugging and kissing on me and all this. And then he starts, you know, pushing me down. And I said, wait a minute, get cool. You don't have to get. And then she's cut off by Bruce Munster, who interrupts her. But Lee continues, you don't have to get rough, you know. And Horzepa's next response, does he ask what rough means? No. He says, where exactly were you sitting in the car? Lee continues, he's getting really heavy with me. He's starting to get violent with me. We're fighting a little bit. Larry Horzepa? Well, what kind of purse did you have? Later, Lee states that Mr. Mallory had not undressed, and then she asked, why didn't you take your clothes off? My God, it hurt. Hurt to do that. Then he got pissed, calling me. He said, fuck you, baby. I'm going to screw you right here and now. And Horzepa responds with yet another question about where they were seated in the car. Did he give Lee Warnos the opportunity to talk? Or did he do everything he could to keep her from talking about the issue that matters most in this case? A final time, Miss Warnos stated how Mr. Mallory kept coming at her and coming at her even after he had been shot. And something that probably will give you better insight about Mr. Horzepa, as you will recall, his answer to that statement on the tape was, he's coming to get you. You already told me that. Where he moves on to another issue. Is Larry Horzepa a man who wants you to hear everything? Or is Larry Horzepa a man who in January of 1991 and again in January of 1992 doesn't want anyone to hear what Richard Mallory was doing to Lee Warnos? Is this a man that wants you to hear about what happened? You remember his testimony from the witness stand. Mr. Tanner asks, how long did she say she had the gun? Mr. Horzepa's response, 2 days. What was the real answer? You saw it. I don't know. Might have been a couple of months, only a couple of months before. I think I might have gotten the gun just then. I can't remember. Like 2 days before or something, because I can't remember. It's been a long time. Was that an honest answer Mr. Horzepa gave you? Question by Mr. Tanner. Did Lee ever explain to you a rape by Mr. Mallory? Answer by Mr. Horzepa. No. What was the real answer? Well, she did say he pushed her. She did say he hurt her. She did say he kept coming at her. He physically abused her. He got rough with her. He got violent with her. And when she complained about being hurt, he shut her up and said, fuck you. I'm going to give it to you now. Now, is that a rape? Can the answer to that question be no? I submit to you, Mr. Horzepa cannot truthfully tell you she did not say she hadn't been raped. He can truthfully tell you she didn't say that word. He didn't want to hear it. And Ty didn't want to hear it. You, however, have heard it. And you heard a nervous and confused Lee Warnos tell you the best she could the rest of the story. A story which was so horrifying, it doesn't take a genius to see why she may not be willing to relay some of those details to a couple of unsympathetic detectives and officers who didn't want to hear it. Lee Warnos told you she would do anything for Tyra Moore. When she met Larry Horzepa and Bruce Munster at Tyra's urging, Lee Warnos was clearly not concerned with herself. You can look at that tape and tell that. The state would have you believe that Miss Warnos somehow was trying to say that she didn't kill this man, and that Tyra had nothing to do with it, but was lying to you. All the important stuff. Remember, Lee Warnos saying in that tape, I deserve to die. What was her motivation for telling these officers that she was assaulted, attacked, and she was defending herself? She wasn't caring about herself in January of 1991. She was caring about Tyra Moore. Despite the efforts of Mr. Horzepa, she was able to tell you as best she could about the day she was being attacked. And later in the courtroom, Lee Warnos may have been confused on that witness stand. She may have been rattled by the skill of cross-examination by Mr. Tanner, but she told you the truth. And if at times she seemed angry at Mr. Tanner's relentless cross-examination, don't forget that Mr. Tanner is here before you, asking you to sentence her to death. It's not going to be long now before you're going to have to go into that jury room and make a very difficult, important decision. It will be difficult for you to do that and concentrate only on Richard Mallory because you spent the last half of your time in the last 2 weeks listening to things that had nothing to do with Richard Mallory. And as you consider those other things, those other things which began in late May, early June 1990, 6 months after Mr. Mallory was killed. Think about these facts. Richard Mallory was shot in late 1989. Lee Warnos had been a prostitute some 17 years prior to that day. And while she had been raped and beaten before, it wasn't until a drunk and stoned Richard Mallory hurt Lee, degraded Lee, and ultimately tortured Lee, that Lee took the action she did. It was only when she laid naked in a strange car and in a dark, secluded place, after having undergone and endured unbearable torture, that she finally took a life to defend herself. You don't know, people, what such an experience did to Lee's mind, whether she could ever be the same again. You do know, however, that she continued to be a prostitute. That's the only work that she knew. She continued to bring money to Tyra Moore, and she continued to go out on the road at least 3 times a week. Several men on each of those days. And you know, therefore, that Lee Warnos had sex with dozens of men in the next 6 months to follow, and you also know from testimony that there were no incidents. And you also know that something happened again when she met David Spears in June of 1990. Maybe something snapped in Lee after that. Maybe she simply couldn't respond to anything harmful again. Those difficult questions are not for you to decide. Those questions are for other juries and other judges. Your job is much simpler because the evidence in this case is much clearer. Far from being a predator, as Mr. Tanner said in his opening statement, Lee Warnos was a victim. She was the victim of a brutal attack. A torturous attack at the hands of Richard Mallory in December of 1989. A violent attack that Mr. Horzepa did his best to keep. Think about the evidence you've heard in the last 2 weeks. You realize that you've not heard a single word suggesting that Eileen Warnos robbed anyone. You've not heard a single word suggesting Eileen Warnos committed felony murder. You've not heard a single word suggesting to you that she shot Mr. Mallory with premeditation. Consider the evidence of Eileen Warnos' intent in December of 1989. All of the evidence suggests that she did nothing but defend herself. The evidence is all in. You heard it. You heard all of it. Follow that evidence where it leads to one simple conclusion, that you'll find Lee Warnos is not guilty.
Now we go to the prosecutor for his closing arguments.
First, I want to thank you. It's been a long 2 weeks, and I know at times you thought your time was wasted and wondered why it seemed to move in slow motion. I can assure you that all of us, and particularly the judge and certainly the counsel on both sides, have been moving this case as rapidly as we could. I can also tell you that all of us, including the judge, have worked through the weekends on this case and tried to minimize the waste of time. I don't think that jury service is any less important than service in the armed services. Certainly, no less important than voting and time you've given, that time you will give. The part of yourselves that you will give as you will deliberate and consider are something for us to be proud of as a nation, as a country, as a system. And it's one of the areas where perhaps our country does exceed in value of human dignity and the value of right, the value of protecting the accused, the value of requiring the government to prove its case, not just say it. The value of all we hold dear is typified and exemplified by what you've been and are now a part of. I think from all our hearts, we thank you for what you're doing. This is the only opportunity I'll have to talk to you until this case is totally over, and then, only if you choose. And this is the only opportunity that I have to argue. As you know, during jury selection, we didn't argue, and during the opening statements, it's probably what you expected, and then We finally got to the final stage of this case where the lawyers offer what we call argument. I'm not sure I like this part of the case, or ever have, but they aren't going to change the system because of the way I feel about it. I would prefer an open exchange, kind of a forum, and let the jurors ask questions and the lawyers answer as best they could, but that's not the way we do it. So, you're going to be stuck with me for about maybe 30 or 40 minutes. I will try not to insult your intelligence, not to bore you, and tell you things that you know very well. I tried to point out what we believe the evidence revealed in this case. First, let me tell you, you're going to receive jury instructions from the court and lawyers on either side are not going to instruct you on the way. We'll mention the law to you from time to time, but the lawyer's argument is not evidence. In other words, what I say is not evidence, and what Mr. Nola's or Mrs. Jenkins or Mr. Miller's team says is not evidence. The only evidence comes from the witness stand or from the exhibits that have been offered. You should not decide this case on sympathy. Not sympathy for Mr. Mallory, and certainly not on sympathy for the accused. You're to decide on the facts and on the evidence before you. Reasonable doubt. We discussed that a lot during jury selection. Listen to the judge's instructions. Reasonable doubt is not some mystical, hard-to-understand concept. But it certainly does put a burden on the state to prove everything beyond any doubt always. It matters that our subject to human beings cannot be proven beyond all doubt. There is no proof, virtually, of anything subject to human interaction that I would say is proved or provable beyond all doubt. Especially when it comes to the matter of crime unwitnessed by anyone except the two people, the victim and the attacker. Premeditation, some of you may have had and still may have in your mind the idea of premeditation is long-range planning, conspiracy-type things, the type of thing that would take days or weeks or even hours. I'd ask you again, listen to the judge's instructions on premeditation. He will instruct you. In fact, with premeditation, you simply carried out an act with an attempt, with an opportunity to reflect upon the action. May only be the time between picking up a firearm and the firing, or may only be between the first and the second shot. Surely by the third shot. Certainly by the fourth shot. Determined intent to kill. You'll hear what felony murders committed in perpetration. In this case of a robbery. You'll hear His Honor tell you that. That's proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That's first-degree murder in Florida. He'll also talk to you about premeditated murder, and that's proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That's also first-degree murder. You will hear about justifiable and excusable homicide, and the way the instructions are framed, and the way they are in every criminal case. You will hear Mr. Mallory's name as, Mr. Mallory is doing this, and she did that, that sort of thing. That doesn't mean the judge has determined anything with regard to the facts, except their version of the case would support an instruction of that nature. It doesn't mean that their version is true. It doesn't mean that the judge has accepted either side. He is more neutral than anyone in this room, and if any of that may have happened in this trial, we had all the newer objections on both sides and the interactions between lawyers, but that's really not part of the case. Sometimes a hard-fought battle over evidentiary matters and legal theories, and the judge has to rule upon it. The evidence we saw was on the witness stand, not what the lawyers are doing or not doing. The evidence is what you should base your verdict on, not performance, not whether you do or don't like one side or the other, and none of us would want you to give that any weight at all. You will receive two verdict forms. One deals with a robbery, and I believe in its final form it has six options. It would be guilty of armed robbery. Guilty of robbery with a deadly weapon, but without a firearm. Guilty of robbery without a firearm or deadly weapon. Guilty of robbery without a firearm. Guilty of petty theft. Or not guilty. You say, well, why? Why did we get all these verdicts? It's a unique creation of the law in America, and perhaps English jurisprudence as well. But when a person is charged, let's say murder in the first degree or robbery, they're also charged with everything within that charge. Perhaps the murder is a little easier to understand. The potential possible verdicts are guilty of murder in the first degree, premeditated, felony murder is charged, or guilty of only first degree premeditated murder. Kind of cringe at the word only. Doesn't seem appropriate, but the law is trying to distinguish guilty of first degree felony murder, guilty of second degree murder, guilty of second degree murder with a firearm, third degree murder with a firearm, manslaughter with a firearm, and not guilty. So, when you're seeing those, don't be confused. They will kind of be in line form, a place to check, and a place for your foreperson to sign. Only check one on each verdict form. I can tell you throughout our argument, our position will be that you should check one at the top, and that is guilty of murder in the first degree, premeditated and felony murder, and also guilty of robbery with a firearm. I could have just said pick E all of the above, but let me read them out to you. Eileen Warnos has been portrayed as a victim by the defense. She's not a victim in any sense of the word. She's not a victim because she's a prostitute. She has chosen to be a prostitute. Her reasons ultimately given was when she first started out, apparently when she was a pretty young woman, was that she only made about 75 cents an hour working when she could make $60 to $100 at a time for sex. And she learned very quickly that was her preferred way of living. And that preference, that choice, has carried on throughout her lifetime. This is not a victim prostitute. This is not a child wandering the streets with no choice. This is a grown woman. A healthy woman with the capability of making an honest living. If she wants to. She has chosen not to. She is not a victim. She indicated that she liked sex. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's one of the reasons she was out there. She tried to push it off on the men. Something to the effect of, well, if they would keep their pants on and keep their wallets in their pocket, we wouldn't be out here. I guess drug dealers can say the same thing. People wouldn't buy drugs or they wouldn't be dealing drugs. Therefore, we should excuse it. It's truly not their fault. They're victims because people want to buy their product. Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
In that vein, let's go back to where we both started. You were told by Mrs. Jenkins that essentially that night Eileen Warnos was hitchhiking, but she was afraid and hiding. Now, what was she afraid of? This is what she does for a living. This is where she chose to work. She chose to work in highways, and she wanted people to pick her up. Where's this aura of fear that she's hiding under the underpass, and doesn't know what to do because she's on the highway stranded? An automobile stopped, and it frightened her. Well, I don't know that you have to be a prostitute hitchhiking. Any hitchhiker is usually delighted when they see your car stopped, and I've submitted she was delighted when she saw the car stopped. It was headed in the direction she wanted to go, and she found it had a lone white male. That is who she preferred to ride with. She got in, and she headed to Daytona. Mrs. Jenkins said that this woman had been beaten and raped repeatedly, and yet Tyra Moore said not once in the 4.5 years they lived together did she ever come home and say someone had been beaten or raped her. It just didn't happen. But she had in the past been beaten pretty badly at one time, if she's telling the truth. But in the past 4.5 years, there's not been any physical assaults upon her, any beatings or rapings, none reported to anyone. Certainly not to her best friend. And if you're going to report that to anyone, you're going to report that to your best friend. Mrs. Jenkins said that time and time again Eileen Warnos was not paid. Well, that may have been true. Maybe sometimes she wasn't paid. Mrs. Jenkins said Mallory told her to disrobe and he wanted her to take her clothes off. But we've learned, even from her own testimony, that it was her policy to take her clothes off. And then they went on to say that after the alleged assault, that she went home and told Ty Moore basically the facts of being raped, sexually assaulted, and the various other very unpleasant things that she heard in the courtroom. And Ty said, well, I don't want to hear her anymore. But that Ty was very supportive. Well, that's not supported in any way at all in this courtroom, in the way of evidence, except the statement of Eileen Warnos. Everyone else's testimony is absolutely the contrary. Mrs. Jenkins, in her opening statement, said that Eileen Warnos was really drunk. Drunk royal. But we heard Eileen Warnos on the stand saying that she had one mixed drink, and then Mr. Mallory bought her a six-pack of beer, and over the next 5 hours she drank. She never even said she contemplated drinking the six-pack of beer. And apparently she had at least one left, if not more, because she had one to drink after she killed him. She sat in the car and drank a beer. That is not a person drunk royal out of their mind. We're going to Mr. Miller's statement from a few moments ago before lunch, and I want to address that directly before I get into some other things I'd like to point out to you. He began to tell you that this was unlike any other case. Well, every case is different, but it's not unusual to have similar fact evidence in a case or tons of other matters that are relevant material brought up in the trial for the substance of the defense. Objection, Your Honor. Overruled. So there's nothing extraordinarily unique about what's happened here in this courtroom. Probably the most unique thing is that it's a woman in this circumstance. That's probably the most unique twist of this whole case. Because this woman set about a pattern of behavior that is unique. You were told by Mr. Miller that other juries in other cases would render verdicts on the other killings, and that is entirely true. You were not here to find her guilty or innocent with regard to the other killings. The only verdict that you're going to be asked to render would be that regarding Mr. Mallory. But at the same time, it doesn't mean you should not fully face your responsibility. I implore you, and I don't think you would, but to not think, oh, someone else will do it. This is your duty today. I trust that you'll face that with courage and the determination that it's going to require. You were also told, regrettably, I think as far as I'm concerned, by Mr. Miller, that your decision had something to do with whether she lived or died, and whether you sentenced her to death by your verdict. That is not where we are in the case at all. This case is divided into two portions, bifurcated legally. We have chosen in court to separate guilt or innocence and the evidence concerning that. And if a verdict is first-degree murder, then what penalty? But under no circumstances does a jury sentence anyone. Objection, Your Honor. Overruled. The judge is the only one who sentences people in this courtroom. Objection, Your Honor, please. I thought we had an agreement that there was not to be objections. They were all reserved, and that he would not interrupt during the trial of my closing. We didn't interrupt them. We did have an agreement, Your Honor. I've been touching on what I thought to be the most serious, and I, Mr. Tanner, apologize for interrupting this closing argument. So, penalty should not even be in your vocabulary, let alone in your mind. Then, Mr. Miller said, all of these other cases had absolutely nothing to do with the murder of Richard Mallory. That's incredible. That's incredible with the law, facts, and circumstances of this case. Similar fact evidence, that is evidence of other crimes, is relevant in material and legal to be considered when ruled admissible by the court in criminal cases, and even in civil cases. The case involving Mr. Mallory, if the case on trial is the only case that you are to determine the guilt or innocence, but with regard to the second victim, Mr. Spears, third, Mr. Carskadden, fourth, Peter Seams, fifth, Troy Burris, Mr. Humphreys, and last, Walter Antonio, in their automobiles, and the locations of where the bodies were found and the cars were found are all relevant material and key issues in this case. Key issues in instructions read to you. I know it was a while ago, but substantially, the same instructions given to you again before you go to the jury room basically indicates that similar fact evidence, that is evidence of other crimes, when it's relevant to prove identity, opportunity, preparation, plan, common scheme, or plan pattern of criminality, intent, or motive. In this case, we submitted the absence of self-defense as relevant, relevant, relevant. It's relevant to what she did to Mr. Mallory. Richard Mallory was killed on December 1st, 11 miles from the downtown Daytona Beach area. He was 51 years old. David Spears, killed in June, 112 miles from the downtown Daytona Beach area. Charles Carskadden, June, 94 miles from Daytona. Peter Seams was reported missing in June. His body was never recovered. This is the one she said she left in Georgia. Troy Burris, the sausage man, this is the way she identified him, found in his vehicle on August 1990, 64 miles from Daytona. Mr. Humphrey, September 1990, 68 miles. Walter Antonio, November, 147 miles. What do these men have in common? All of them were white males between the ages of 39 and 60 years old. They're all traveling major thoroughfares in Florida. They're all traveling alone. Each of them made one fatal mistake and picked up Eileen Warnos. In each of those cases, she propositioned them for sex. And she ultimately killed them all in an isolated area where there would be no witnesses. She shot every one of them in the torso. A couple she also shot in the head. Multiple gunshot wounds, all from a .22 caliber. You've heard the bullets described over and over again. Virtually the same bullets. Same pistol as was used by her. Everyone's property was stolen. Their vehicles were taken. And the vehicle was wiped clean in the case of Mr. Mallory. Mr. Spears, Mr. Carskadden's vehicle, was stripped and on the side of the highway. Police couldn't really do much with it. Peter Seams, the one that was turned over on the 4th of July, and both women were in that car. Both women were riding around in that car. I say both women, meaning Eileen Warnos and Tyria Moore. And that's the vehicle where Miss Warnos' bloody handprint was found. The other three vehicles were all wiped clean. Again, the license plate was removed on five of the seven vehicles. All the vehicles were left abandoned, and they were left abandoned with a range of 12 to 170 miles. Finally, the property of three of the five men were found in her mini warehouse. This evidence demonstrates a pattern and a method of criminality and intent and plan to carry out robberies and murders on all the highways in the state of Florida by this woman. And she had picked a selected target of the type of individual she killed. In our opening, I told you that on November the 30th, 1989, that 51-year-old Richard Mallory turned east on I-4. He didn't know that he was living in the last 10 hours of his life. He didn't know that in less than 10 hours he would be robbed and left to rot in the woods. Of course, he didn't know he was about to pick up this woman. Nor did he know that for whatever reason, she had begun to change her course of conduct, as far as we know, to a lethal and deadly pattern that would be reenacted over the next year, 7 times. Her appetite to control men, and that's what most prostitutes are about beside money, is control. tremendous control. To take away all men have physically, some say spiritually, is tremendous and almost absolute control. There's only one thing left, and that's to kill him. You can't have much more of one person except their life. That's what she wanted, and that's what she took. The evidence. Let's look at Dr. Botling's evidence. Let's look at what his testimony showed us. Would a chart or drawing of Mr. Mallory's body have told you any more than this shirt? This was the shirt he was wearing when she killed him. As best as we can reconstruct from the shirt from a dead man and her testimony, her various stories, is that he was sitting in the car behind the wheel. No question about that. We also know that a bullet, perhaps the first bullet, and that coincides with their testimony by the way of her stories, entered in the rear of the shirt, rear right arm in the shoulder, went through the armpit and into his chest. That's not indicative to a man on his knees over the top of and attacking a woman. That's indicative of a man with his hands on the wheel. And we will never know. All we have is her and the evidence of a man shot in the back. But we don't have a man on his knees over a victim. It's not there. The evidence disproves that. The bullets. There's no way for us to know in what order. We can't only go with what she said, plus the evidence of the autopsy, plus our common sense. But if he did, in fact, say, oh, when he was shot, and like she said, he did when she thought she shot him in the side, from the outside of the vehicle, that would probably be the first shot. And then perhaps the second shot in the vehicle up in and through the neck, from the neck up, was so decomposed with no track of the bullet discernible. So there was a definite track of a bullet within, and it was horizontal across the body, not up and back. And then there are the other two shots that we believe were delivered after she ran around in front of the car, as she described, one of them slightly from the right angle and traversing, and arguably that could have been delivered from the other side of the car, as she moved around. And he was in there trying to get further away from her. We know, according to what she told the detectives, that he tried to get away and tried to get out the door and shut it. And he crawled out of the car. In her words, crawled out of the car. And then she ran around the front of the car and came around, and she said that she says, got up. She shot him again. He fell down. She shot him again. And here she tells it a little different. I don't know that there's any comfort for her, but she said, I went around to the door and opened it. And why do you think she went around to the door and opened it? If that's what she did? If what she told the police wasn't true, but what she told you was true, why'd she go around there and open the door? She hadn't finished killing him. That's the only reason in the world for her to be enclosed with this man again. That's her best story. That's the best story she has. She told detectives that she shot him again after he went down. And you know, that's confirmed, perhaps. Certainly supported as a viable action because the bullet, according to Dr. Botting, went straight in and the others had an angle. Straight in, indicative of a shot delivered straight down. If you prefer to accept her version, she opened the door. He's looking at her and shot him there. Either one, it's first degree murder. You don't have to debate and wonder what if she shot him laying down or laying up. The point is, she was going over there to kill him. And that's what she did. That's exactly what she meant to do. That's what she intended to do. When asked, why did you kill him? Right near the end of her testimony, why did you kill him? She said the police would never believe a prostitute. That's the best story she had. That's the best story she had today. And so, therefore, I had no choice but to go ahead and snuff him out. Witness elimination. Even if the whole story were true, even if the whole thing was true, you have no right to go over there and snuff out his life because she's afraid someone might not believe her. She was determined to kill him for whatever reason, and she told us, why would Ty Moore come in here and lie? They were very close. They were good friends. They were lovers. Close as peas in a pod. Close as ties and a knot. We hear all those descriptions by Miss Warnos. We're not denied one time by Ty Moore. Eileen Warnos said Ty knew it was self-defense, and she might be in trouble if she told us it was self-defense. Now, how would that cause trouble? If anything, it might give us some moral justification to the fact that Ty Moore didn't come forward and tell us about this killing. That she believed her girlfriend was raped, brutalized. Therefore, because of the horrible things done to her, she didn't tell me about it because the guy deserved to die anyway. We're not going to tell anybody. She killed a rapist, and I knew about it. That would have been the most logical story if, in fact, it was true. But it wasn't true. It was not true because it is not true. She never told Ty Moore. What she told Ty Moore several times, just before the noose came on and she was drinking, she being Miss Warnos. And she knew this car she'd been driving around in that day was suddenly going to be on television, because there was now a body. You know, simply an abandoned car wasn't going to make the news. When a car linked to a rotting body makes the news 2 weeks later. 2 weeks later, she realized, uh-oh, Ty Moore knows I have his car. Ty didn't really borrow this car. This guy was found with his body in the woods. And Ty goes, what are you talking about? And finally she said, well, I killed this guy. And Ty says, what? You're blanking me. What? You're kidding. No, I killed this guy. And that's it. That was the whole story. That was it. That was her best friend, roommate, sweetheart, companion. Doesn't tell her anything. That is incredulous. You don't need an expert or pathologist to tell you what common sense tells you. In fact, if it was a story, Miss Warno said Ty wanted a story that she's going to make, gosh, I don't know. It sounded like $5 million or $500,000. Either one is a lot of money. She's going to make a lot of money by lying about this self-defense thing. Well, that's not true, is it? Wouldn't it be a much more interesting story and a much more sellable story if this poor, pitiful prostitute simply doing her job and some guy did some horrible things to her and she killed in self-defense? Now, that's a good story. That one's even better. And then her girlfriend, who knew all about it, got on the stand, told the jury how it was self-defense and how Eileen came in. She had bruises on her neck. She could hardly talk, 'cause the rope had almost choked her. And brutally beaten, and that he ministered to the private parts of her body because they were torn and there was blood in her clothes and in her underwear, and that this was a terrible thing. Then, despite the fact that this poor woman was raped and brutalized by this animal, the state of Florida tried to convict her, and a good, reasonable jury saved her. Now that's a good story. That would sell a lot of books and movies, and would be a gross injustice. The attack upon Deputy Horzepa, who is not responsible for what items are or are not presented as evidence, the prosecution is responsible, along with the defense, ruled upon by the court as to what you receive in evidence. Deputy Horzepa has done nothing except sit here and testify under oath, like any other witnesses, and tell you what he did and what he had. She said that she was cut off continuously and couldn't finish her statement. Her lawyer was sitting right there. Would any lawyer, allow the police to cut off his client so she couldn't tell her story? If she had a story to tell in 3 hours and some odd minutes, is there one shred of evidence or testimony about her where she says she was tied up even? Even tied up? I thought the story was going to be that a coat hanger was used to tie her up. There was an issue about a coat hanger. If there was a straight coat hanger, and I didn't know, and we didn't know where it's going. We just wait till it hits the stand, same as you. So, we spent about 30 minutes on a coat hanger that didn't mean anything. In fact, we also didn't find any electrical wire or rope abandoned at either place. Found the evidence of drinking, perhaps some partying. She was told to tell it all. She was told that she had an opportunity to tell everything. She did tell us something. She said what she deserved, but she never told anything about a rape. She mentioned the word rape a couple times, spread out of 7 stories of men. She never said that Mr. Mallory raped her. Certainly never said that he tied her to the steering wheel. In fact, I recall I asked her about this anal rape thing, and she said, "No, no, that's a different story. That's a different man. Can't talk about it." She has told you virtually everyone in the courtroom is lying. Even Bobby Copas. Remember Mr. Copas? Looks like a trucker. Pretty big guy. I guess there are some skinny truckers out there, but most truckers look big. At least in the movies and in this case. Even Mr. Copas, she said, is a liar. And I don't like to use that word. That's what she said. Because he wants publicity? Well, did Richard Mallory give her money in advance? And then was she afraid he was going to take it back? Like she said in her first statement? Or was he just a nice guy and she decided she trusted him? She wasn't worried about the money until they got to arguing about unzipping his pants. And she said in her second story, had she had the gun for 2 months or 2 days? Well, she's the one that corrected herself. She is the one who narrowed it down to 2 days. Said, oh, wait a minute. And went back to that herself. It wasn't due to prompting by anyone else. That's why we accepted that as the best version and put it into evidence, because it was only a couple of days after she said she got the gun that the killings began. Something about having a gun. It changes some people. And maybe it's a good thing we don't let convicted felons have guns, despite her views to the contrary. She was pretty astute on the stand, and certainly 2 hours on the stand or so would not be easy for anyone, but she was able to correct me on what pages in the transcript where certain matters were. Well, I know that's on page 9. Well, that's on page 53. And I said, well, we haven't gotten there yet. We'll get there in a few minutes. Asked her about the trajectory of the bullets. Remember Dr. Bodding talked about the trajectory of the bullets, and she said, oh, I thought the body was too decomposed to tell the trajectory of the bullet. She wasn't missing a lick. She knows what she's doing. And she has carried a pattern on manipulation into the courtroom to try to manipulate your verdict. She told you that she was threatened with the arrest and prosecution of Ty Moore, and that's the only reason she said all these things. I think there's a clear choice there. Either Deputy Horzepa is flat out sitting here not telling you the truth, or she's not. There's no gray area there. Someone of the two is not telling you the truth. In fact, in her testimony, she said, I'm the only one telling the truth. Everybody else is lying. I think she said, except me and my lawyers. But everyone else is lying to convict an innocent person? She told Ty Moore just enough that Ty wouldn't flip out when she saw the car on the television that she'd been riding in 2 weeks earlier. And she didn't tell her anything else. Ty Moore should have gone to the police. Ty Moore should have reported it. Maybe, just maybe, it would have stopped right there on the stand. Timor's going to have to live with that. Timor is not on trial. This is a murder trial for Eileen Wuornos. That's where it should have ended. This is because people don't want to get involved. And my goodness, we've seen some witnesses here. You see why they don't want to get involved, but we've got to get involved. You've got to get involved. The system isn't going to work if we hide behind our privacy and our fears and our private lives. Timor, her refusal to either believe or accept and believe, and then tell anyone, could have saved 6 men's lives. And that doesn't hold her up to anything respectful or honorable at all. At the same token, if she would have told it was a brutal anal rape, torture, etc., it would have at least got some moral justification for not saying anything. And she knows that. And she would have said that if it was true. Because it was not true. She didn't say it. It was not bad enough that she didn't come forward. At least she didn't sit on that witness stand and lie to you to perpetrate and protect this woman who killed Mr. Mallory. We heard a lot from her. This is a murder out of greed. This is a woman who would make, according to her own testimony, I don't care how you figure it, $30,000 to $50,000 a year and squander it just as quickly. This is a woman moving out of power and control into a new and unfathomable, for you and I, an area of domination to the extent of snuffing out someone's life. It became obscenely simple to have it all. Is there any answer to the whys and how this happened? Not for this jury, not for this time, and not for us. She chose her life. She chose the time and place. And she has left you no reasonable choice under the evidence in this case but to find her guilty of murder in the first degree and armed robbery. Thank you very much.
Eileen's defense attorney, Mr. Miller, comes up one last time to talk to the jury and give his last remarks.
Forgive me if I'm a little disjointed in my final remarks to you, members of the jury. I have a lot of things to respond to what you just heard. I would start out by agreeing with Mr. Tanner about one thing, and that is that your service is vital in this case. It's an exceedingly important job. Take it seriously and think about everything you have heard. When you're doing that, demand of Mr. Tanner proof, not speculation. Demand of Mr. Tanner evidence. Mr. Tanner just talked about, well, maybe he was like this, or maybe he was lying down, or maybe a straight shot means he was lying down. Well, maybe a straight shot means that this man was coming right at this woman, and maybe a straight shot means he was right on top of her. How did the shot get into his arm? Think about it. It's a man coming into a car to get a woman. Maybe that's how it happened, or maybe it's don't cut it in a court of law. Maybe he's don't work. Perhaps doesn't work. The burden is on the state, and the state has given you nothing. Demand more. Mr. Tanner speculates, well, you know, Ty would have been on moral high ground if she had come in here and said something about being told that Lee was anally raped by Mr. Mallory. What better reason for Ty Moore not to go to the police when she was first told about it? Lee Wuornos told you that she told Ty Moore about this thing, that it happened. And there's no better evidence than what Mr. Tanner pointed out to you. Mr. Tanner spoke some about the robbery charge in this case. You listen carefully to the robbery instruction, and you listen to whether or not there was any evidence that Lee Wuornos threatened anybody or killed anybody or did anything to get property. Is Lee Wuornos guilty of theft? Sure. Find her guilty of theft. She should have not taken that property. I suggest to you that you don't have to find her guilty of theft, and that her state of mind was such that can be excused. but there's no legal justification for finding her guilty of robbery. I also agree with Mr. Tanner about another thing, and that is that we don't want you to rely on sympathy. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for Lee Warnos. She doesn't need your sympathy. She needs fairness. She needs justice. She needs you to really understand what really happened in 1989, and she needs you to return a fair verdict. She needs you to interpret exactly what the evidence that came from that stand has told you. And that is that she had every right to shoot Mr. Mallory. She had every right to shoot him. Not once, not twice, not three, but four times. She was terrified. She was drunk. She was naked. She was tortured. And she defended herself. That's not a crime. I won't ask you for sympathy. The law says she's not guilty. Mr. Tanner also got up here and spoke to you about the fact that Eileen Warnos is a prostitute. Eileen Warnos asked to be a prostitute. Well, did Eileen Warnos ask to be slapped? Did she ask to be tied to a steering wheel? Did she ask to be anally assaulted? Each and every one of you in the jury selection indicated that you can be fair. Each and every one of you indicated that a prostitute, yes, a prostitute can be raped. Mr. Tanner suggests to you that this somehow, she brought this all onto herself because of her profession. She was raped, she was brutalized, and despite her profession, she had a right to defend herself. Mr. Tanner quarrels with Mrs. Jenkins' opening statement and says, well, what was she hiding from? I believe if you listen carefully, the opening statement was that Miss Warnos was underneath the culvert because it was raining and it was dark. And when this car backed up, that in fact she was worried about who might be inside. And that's exactly what she told you from the witness stand. Then Mr. Tanner went on to say, well, Lee told you that she told Ty what happened back in December of 1989 and that she had told Ty that it was self-defense. But everyone else said something different. Whereas everyone else, you got Tyra Moore. And you got Eileen Warnos. What do you mean, everyone else? And what are Ty's motivations? Mr. Tanner asked you, why would Ty lie? Don't forget who her friends are in this case. Mr. Tanner suggests, well, self-defense will make a much better book. A much better movie. Yeah, except the person who told her about the $50,000 and the book and the movie deals was a law enforcement officer. Her best buddies. And Rose Giansani of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Well, what are her motivations to come in here and say something to convict Lee Warnos? You be the judge. Mr. Tanner talks a lot about prostitutes and control and taking the man for everything he has. Have you heard one single shred of evidence that talks to you about what prostitutes think? Have you heard an expert come in and read prostitutes' minds? What did Lee tell you about prostitution? About the numerous times she was beaten? About the fact that her lover didn't even want to hear about it? For a lover who was more than willing to take her money, but didn't want to hear about it? Mr. Tanner quotes Lee and says, well, I told her that I killed this man. Speaking of what she said to Ty, and Ty's response was, you're blanking me, I don't believe this. That's what Lee said in 1991. And why did she say that? It's obvious. The whole reason she was there was to clear Ty. What's she gonna say? I told her all about it and she believed me. But she didn't do anything? And Lee told you from the stand that's why she made those comments as well. She told you that. The fact of the matter is, Ty Moore told you that her response to Lee was, you're blanking me. Ty Moore told you 2 weeks ago that her response was, I didn't want to hear about it. And that's what really happened. When you look at the evidence in this case, look carefully at this photograph of Mr. Mallory's vehicle. You heard Lee Warnos talk about a rape, and you heard how she said she was tied to the steering wheel. You look at the steering wheel, look at the condition of the steering wheel, and ask yourselves, is that consistent with what Lee Warnos said? It is. and Mr. Tanner said something that was almost humorous. He said, well, if Lee was getting cut off, she had her lawyer there. How come her lawyer didn't do anything? Watch the tape. Listen to that lawyer. First of all, it is enormously difficult to understand a word he says because his accent is so thick. Second of all, she'd never met the man before in her life. Third of all, he didn't say a word other than making a blanket statement to cover himself. That, I kind of talked to her about the fact that she doesn't have to testify. And more importantly, he left in the middle of the interview. Mr. Tanner spent a lot of time talking about Mr. Botting. And then he speculated as to what the sequence must have been based on all these things and principles. What did Dr. Botting tell you? This is his expert. This is what he put on the stand to teach you what happened. He said, I don't know what sequenced. I can't say what position. I can't say what they were doing. He certainly said, I can't tell what was happening before the shots were fired. The state has given you nothing to show anything except self-defense in this case. Nothing. Mr. Tanner, in essence, is arguing to you, you have to convict Lee Warnos based on what she did not say. You have to convict Lee Warnos based on what she did not say at certain times. The fact of the matter is, you must acquit Lee Warnos because of what she did say, both in January of 1991 and here in this courtroom. When you consider that Mr. Spears and Mr. Kirkscadden and the other things that Mr. Tanner talked to you about, he suggested that somehow I argued that it wasn't admissible. Of course those items are admissible. You saw them. If they were not admissible, they wouldn't be here. What I suggest to you is that they are meaningless in this case, and they are for other jurors, and they are for other judges, because what Mr. Tanner did not explain to you when he went through the dates on these things is that, yes, Richard Mallory was killed in December of 1989. David Spears died in June of 1990, 6 months later. The things that happened after Lee Warnos went through the hell she went through in December of 1989 are not indicative of what she was thinking at that time. It's not logical to assume that her behavior 6 months later had anything to do with whether or not she was being savagely raped. If anything, her rape explains any future behavior. He didn't hear anything about anyone in November of 89, or October of 1989, or September of 1989, or 87, or 85, or 75. It wasn't until Richard Mallory did what he did that Lee Warnos responded. The evidence is clear that she had every right to do that. You're about to go into that room. You're going to be instructed on the law first. And when you go back there, demand proof from the state. Not speculation. Consider what you've heard on that witness stand. Consider Larry Horzepa and Tyra Moore for what they are. And consider whether or not Bobby Kopus was telling you the truth. Consider how many times Lee Warnos cried out that she responded in self-defense in this case. When you do that, when you assimilate all that you've heard over the last 2 weeks, there's only one verdict that you can come to. And that verdict is not guilty on each and every count.
Thank you so much for listening to Part 5. Stay on the lookout next week for Part 6. Until next time, stay safe and take care.